to what had befallen the man. I had expected that Mr. MacDonald and I would hit it off that day. Julie had motioned me into her office that afternoon while Mr. MacDonald was telling a story about how he hated Eskimos. It was not so much a story, really, as a string of words that was randomly assembled, incoherent, unending, and filled with hate. Every piece of clothing he wore advertised something he had done in the entertainment business at some time. He may as well have had "has-been" stenciled on his forehead. I knew I had my work cut out for me with this one. You wouldn't know it now, but I was a great man once. A fine young man, alive with ideas. And suddenly I found myself an old man, standing in a doorway as Mr. MacDonald spoke of how he didn't trust Eskimos and never would. I had never felt such instant animus toward anyone. I remember thinking that this time I might not take the job. I might just walk out of the office. But I stayed put as Mr. MacDonald mercifully finished his story. And so anyways, the point is, I've never met an Eskimo I liked. Not once. Not ever. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've ever even met an Eskimo. I call them blubber eaters, by the way. And don't even get me started on the filthy Swedes. He struck the table with his fist, and Julie burst into laughter. I'd heard many silly celebrities tell their silly stories in my time. They always amused me, the way a harmless child amuses me. But Mr. MacDonald appalled me, the way a harmful child appalls me. For the first time, he fixed his sluggard's eyes on me. "Who are you, old man?" "The name's Keene, Mr. MacDonald. Terence Keene." I extended my hand, and he shook it with great strength, the way weak men always do. He finally stopped, and I stood there, clasping and unclasping my hand, hoping the brute hadn't broken it in his effort to prove his manhood. "I will be your ghostwriter." Mr. MacDonald lit up a cigarette in a non-smoking building and shot a look at Julie. Julie, abashed, cast her eyes down. "Oh, yes, Terence. Norm was just explaining to me that he has no need for a ghostwriter, only a secretary." "That's right, mister," said Mr. MacDonald. "I'm a great writer. Written sketches, jokes, gags, all kinds of things. A memoir will be nothing for a guy like me. Problem is, I never learned to type. Back when I went to school, very few boys took any typing classes, if you catch my drift. What about you, Keene? Did you ever take any typing classes?" He looked at me with a stupid smirk. Of course I'd caught his drift. It was the kind of drift you'd catch upon entering a gas station restroom. But I wasn't about to be cowed by this bullying clown. "As a matter of fact, I did. Yes. Most useful class I took in high school. I can type 75 words a minute." MacDonald looked over at Julie. "I guess he'll do. Although I gotta tell you, when I pictured having a secretary, I figured she'd have a nice set of cans." He then looked to me. "No offense, Keene, but yours look kind of floppy." And then he let out a big hoary laugh, which was followed by Julie's delighted squeal. "Oh, you are incorrigible, Norm. Absolutely incorrigible. Isn't he, Terence?" "Yes," I managed. "A true scapegrace." I just stood there, burning up inside, and I guess Julie noticed, because she stopped laughing and turned to me. "Of course, Terence, the deal would be the same as if you were the ghostwriter. The standard 10% plus. Mr. MacDonald will receive $1 million upon receipt of the manuscript, and you will be paid $100,000. That cooled me down considerably, because that was a great deal of money for a celebrity memoir, especially a celebrity who hadn't worked in years. "Wow," Mr. MacDonald said. "100K, that's easy money for you, Keene. I'll tell you the stories, and all you have to do is write them down, word for word, that's it. You don't have to add your own opinions, nobody's interested. If you can type as fast as you claim, we should be able to finish this thing in a week." I looked at him closely to see if he was joking. He wasn't. "I'll tell you what, Mr. MacDonald, why don't I begin with a little cursory research on you, and we can get to work presently. I feel this collaboration will work out splendidly, sir, just splendidly. How does that sound to you?" "It sounds womanish." I beg your pardon?" "I mean the way you say splendidly. Just sounds womanish, that's all. Now don't get me wrong. I don't care what filthy things a man does with another man when they lay down together, but I just don't want any words like splendidly showing up in this book. You understand me, brother?" His eyes were dull, and he took a menacing step toward me, and I backed up to the door. And in a moment I was out on the streets of a big, busy city and away from the vile man, and it felt fine. As a matter of fact, it felt splendid. Splendid, splendid, splendidly, 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 splendidly.
Chapter 14. Live from New York. "Oh, now I understand," says Adam Egan. "Of course, everything happens for a reason. And the reason you did really bad at Star Search was so that you could not get The Tonight Show. Of course, it's so clear now." "Adam Egan, are you trying to be sarcastic?" His eyes lower. "I suppose." "There's more to the story," Gabe says. "But I'm not going to be around to listen to it again. I hear there's a juicy 30-60 game over at the Bellagio. See you later. Be careful out there." And just like that, Gabe is gone. "Tell me the rest of the story, Norm." "Sure," I say. "I'll tell you and one other guy. See, I'm writing a book, and they gave me a secretary. And get this, the secretary is a man." "Is this one of those riddles?" Adam Egan says. "I'm not good at those." "No riddle, no joke. He's a man secretary. He can even type. I phone and tell him stories, and he types them out. I met him before this trip, and I moved in with him for a month. I figured that would be way more than enough time to finish the book. But I guess the old fool couldn't type as fast as he claimed." "Does the man secretary have a nice house, Norm?" "It's okay. I was going to go back there and finish the book, but then I got the plan." Adam Egan puts a big smile on his squid face. "Say, Norm, why don't you go back to the man secretary and live with him till you're finished?" "Nice try," I say, and I phone Keene's number and get his answering machine. That makes me happy. If he answered, he'd be sure to talk, and that would just slow me down. "Okay, Keene. Okay, Adam Egan, listen, and hear about my first week at SNL. That was a long time ago, so I take a deep, deep drag and hold the magic stuff in my lungs, although it fights to get out. Finally, I can't take it anymore, and I lean over and cough like hell. When I look up again, there it is, the past. It's directly in my face, like a forgotten child who's hunted me down to find out when I'll be returning with that pack of cigarettes." After the Carson episode, my agent fired me, and I got laughed out of Hollywood. I ended up in New York, where I slept in the Central Park Zoo, next to the polar bears. I got lucky. Robert Morton, the booker for Late Night with David Letterman, was at my first show at Catch a Rising Star. The next day, I got a call that would change my life. "You're on the show. Just one question. You're not that idiot who turned down Carson, right?" "No," I said. I had my suspicions about him, but I had learned my lessons about trust, and it turned out that Morty was the real deal. A month later, David Letterman, the funniest man in the world, put me on his show and gave me his stamp of approval. Everything moved quickly after that. Adam Sandler had been a friend since my early days of stand-up and had always had my back. It was Adam who persuaded Jim Downey, the head writer of SNL, to watch my Letterman performance. "He's not that idiot who turned down Carson," said Jim. "Yes," said Adam. Jim laughed. "Oh, we got to get that guy on the show." Jim, in turn, recommended me to Lorne Michaels. "He's not that idiot who turned down Carson," said Lorne. "No," said Jim. People were beginning to talk about me, and that's always good news. As Adolf Hitler once said, all publicity is good publicity. Soon after, I was offered the opportunity to audition for Lorne. Back when I started, Lorne began the year by taking all the cast and crew to a place called Mohonk, a lakeside resort at the foot of the Catskills. The idea was that the new writers and performers could meet and bond with the veterans in a relaxed atmosphere. We were like one great big dysfunctional family, except we were not related, and we all got along famously. But we were great, and we were big. The year I started, Jay Moore and Sarah Silverman also joined the cast, and Dave Attell became one of the writers. They were all very cool and very talented, and this made me very afraid. I was not used to seeing famous people, so the week at Mohunk was both intimidating and exciting. The stars, like Mike Myers, Phil Hartman, and Tim Meadows, were all there, along with legendary writers Robert Smigel, Ian Maxtone Graham, Tom Davis, and Jim Downey. I instantly bonded with Downey, who was the only person at SNL who had completed less formal education than I had, having dropped out of school in the second grade. But Downey had street smarts. And even if he couldn't tell you who Newton or Shakespeare was, he could tell you plenty about the guys he had met in the streets, like this one guy named Bill, and this other guy named Bob. The first night at Mohunk, the whole cast and crew gathered in the dining room. Adam Sandler, David Spade, Rob Schneider, and I were sitting at a table together, and they were going on and on about how funny Chris Farley was and how much I was going to love him. But I'd heard that about plenty of guys in my time. I'd be the judge of that. The dinner was winding down with a lot of boring comedy talk about what was funny and what wasn't funny, when, suddenly, something funny happened. The doors burst open, and a naked Farley entered, doing his impression of a salad, shoving baby tomatoes up his ass and dousing himself with oil and vinegar. The room went crazy, and Sandler yelled in my ear, "What did I tell you?" Well, they were right. I'd never seen anything close to that before. Later in the evening, when I was officially introduced to Chris, I was surprised to find he'd taken on a serious tone. He'd leaned into me and whispered that there was something very important he had to tell me, and it was a matter of some urgency. He secreted me to a room where we could be alone, locked the door, and cased the place to be sure no one was listening. He made me swear that what he was about to tell me must never leave the room. I was thrilled that the great Farley was taking me, a complete stranger, into his confidence and excited to learn what all this cloak and dagger was about. After I took the oath of secrecy, Chris drew me close and whispered in my ear, "Pat is actually a woman!" And then that big Chris laugh. Man, I miss that laugh. That big Chris laugh. During that trip, I tucked deep into the night with Lorne Michaels. He explained to me that it was a time of profound change at SNL. The brilliant sketch players, Dana Carvey, John Lovitz, Jan Hooks, along with the tech-sharp Dennis Miller, had all ended their tenure on the show. Mike Myers and Phil Hartman would soon be following suit. It was hard to imagine they could be replaced. Who would dare fill the shoes of the greatest sketch troupe ever assembled? Those who came after were cut from wholly different cloth, Lauren explained. There were four: Farley, Schneider, Spade, and the top dog, Sandler. Other than Farley, none of these boys had any experience in sketch acting. They didn't come from Second City or the Groundlings. They came from the smoky nightclubs of America. They were stand-ups, and they worked alone. It looked bad for the new cast, and Lauren predicted that the press would mention it often. Lauren called them the not-ready-for-the-not-ready-for-primetime players. But the boys were adapting, Lauren explained. They were using their stand-up skills to their advantage, playing not to each other or the studio audience, but over all that and to the camera, to the home audience itself. They performed in the sketch and watched it at the same time, often laughing at the silliness of it all. "These kids are in the serious business of deconstruction," And in Sandler's case, said Lorne, it will often rise to a glorious dereliction of duty. Most all of this I didn't understand, but I nodded whenever I felt it was appropriate, and I certainly agreed with Lorne that these four guys were the Beatles of comedy. Lorne told me that this change in the show's tone would not sit well with many of the writers, and I soon learned what he meant. There was a sharp divide between the ones who embraced the new comedians and the ones who rejected them. Lorne Michaels, Tim Herlihy, Ian Maxtone Graham, Jim Downey, and Robert Smigel loved the anarchy of it all. But others vocally did not, and that week at Mohawk was filled with dissension between the two camps. On the final night, Adam Sandler told me the following season would be a rough, divisive one, and he wanted to know which side I'd take. I told him I wanted to be on the side of the guy who had shoved the baby tomatoes up his ass. Adam smiled. Chapter 15, A Little Fame. That's when you moved to the Regency House, right, Norm? Yes, that's right, Adam Egan. Remember the Regency House? Makes me kind of sad remembering. They say my father's house has many mansions, but the one I live in now is no great digs. Four men to a room, and you have to be back before 9 in the evening, and you can't have whiskey on your breath, or Mrs. Sullivan will turn her back to you, and the hard pavement of the nickel will be your pillow. But back in the day... Oh, back in the day... The Regency House. The Regency House sat on Central Park West and had a lot of kids from SNL living in it. Kevin Nealon, Phil Hartman, Timmy Meadows, even the great Adam Sandler. And Laurie Jo Hoekstra. Laurie Jo was a writer's assistant who got me into the joint. It was great to move out of Central Park Zoo. Polar bears make for terrible neighbors. Laurie Jo was the smartest and funniest woman I had ever met, and she was hotter than a $2 pistol to boot. She eventually became my producer on Weekend Update, and then my producing partner on everything thereafter. Truth be told, any success I ever attained would have been impossible without Laurie Jo. I lived way up on the 35th floor of the Regency House, and had a beautiful view of the wall of another 35th floor of another New York apartment building. We were a stone's throw away from work, and I'd often walk there with Sandler, who everyone knew and loved. The doorman, Steve, always had a good word for Adam, and liked to talk to him about the show from the week before. Sometimes he liked it, and sometimes he didn't, but he always loved Adam. Adam introduced me to Steve and told him that I was on the show as well. Steve looked puzzled, and I explained that, although I was technically on the show, I had yet to actually be on the TV. Steve looked even more puzzled. "Well, you don't worry, Steve," Sandler said. You'll be seeing plenty of Normie." That's all it took. After that, I was good with Steve. One day, I left my apartment and got in the elevator. There was a girl standing in it. Her head was bent down, and she quietly wept. So I ignored her. On the 21st floor, a man got on the elevator. He was a real gregarious, New York kind of guy. As soon as he saw the girl, he jumped into action. "Hey, honey, what's the matter?" he asked. And she mumbled through sniffles, to which he replied, "Let me tell you something. Everything's going to turn out all right, okay? This guy knows." And he motioned to me, but I didn't know, so I stayed silent. We all got out of the elevator, and I went to get my mail, and when I got back to the lobby, the gregarious fellow was still talking to the girl, who was still quietly weeping. He was telling her how things always worked out, how matters that were substantial today were trivial tomorrow. He told her that he would take her to have coffee in the Greek diner around the corner, and that everything was going to be just fine. And she nodded as they left. On my way back up to my apartment, I was spotted by Steve, the doorman. His eyes were bright and he smiled. I knew why. He had seen me on the show the previous Saturday. It was my first time on screen. Tim Herlihy had put me in a Star Trek sketch where I had one line. Beam me up, Scotty. That was good enough for Steve the doorman. Hey, hey, look who it is. Beam me up, Scotty. How you feeling this fine morning, beam me up, Scotty? I'm good, Steve. Real good. I'm going to go upstairs to my apartment, have a cigarette and coffee, and read the daily news. Attaboy, beam me up, Scotty, said Steve the doorman. From then on, that was how Steve the doorman knew me. When I got home from work, I could always rely on a hearty, good evening to you, beam me up, Scotty. He was always excited to see me, because I was a famous guy who went on the TV every Saturday night and said, beam me up, Scotty. The problem was, only he and I knew that, and everyone in the vicinity would just look at me, awed. One time I was going through the door and Steve was having a conversation with a friend, which he abruptly stopped when he saw that such a famous figure as I was at the door. Hey, beam me up, Scotty. I'd like you to meet a friend of mine, John. He's a good guy. Always been there for me, you know what I mean? You don't find that often in this life. John, I'd like you to meet. Beam me up, Scotty. John shook my hand and said, sorry, what was your name? Steve got embarrassed that his friend was so ignorant of popular culture, and he slapped the back of his glove on the chest of John's heavy coat and reproached him. What's the matter with you, Johnny? This is Beam Me Up Scotty from the TV. Then he looked at me. Go ahead, do it for him. Beam me up, Scotty, I said. John just looked at me for a long moment, bewildered, and then said, oh, yeah, sure, I know you. Sure you know him, Steve said. He's Beam Me Up Scotty. And outside the Regency House, we all laughed loudly for different reasons in the cold autumn of New York. A little fame can be an embarrassing thing, and I was to learn that lesson often. I mean, I'm used to it now, like when Mr. Abernathy says, hey, Biscopo, that stew's not all for you, you know. Mr. Abernathy, he's lived at the boarding house forever, and when I first moved in, he called me Piscopo, and I never corrected him. I should have years ago, but if you don't do something right away, you never do it. And after all, one name is as good as another. One time, that first year on SNL, I got recognized by an actual celebrity. It was Slash, whom I had admired for some time, both for his incredible guitar playing and his hat. It would never occur to me that a guy like Slash would even know a bum like me existed. But that's the great thing about showbiz. A famous guy like Slash, whom you've never met in your life, runs up to you in the streets of New York, shakes your hand, and treats you like you're both old friends. How you doing, buddy? What's new? Oh, not much, Slash. Just same old. You know how it is. Hurry up and wait. Yeah, don't I know it. When you're in showbiz, and you meet another guy in showbiz, you're supposed to play it cool. But me, I get real nervous. Slash asked if we could speak in confidence, and so we found a corner where we could talk and be unheard by the unfamous. Slash leaned into me close. Have you talked to Chucky lately? I didn't know anyone named Chucky. Not for a while, no, I said. Why? Slash got even quieter. He's not in good shape. When was the last time you talked to him? I felt sweat everywhere. I don't know. Probably 4 months? He seemed pretty good, considering. I knew I had to get out of there quickly, before Slash realized I was not who I was pretending to be, a close friend of his who shared a mutual friend named Chucky with him. Chucky, who was not in good shape. But I could hardly just run away. Listen, said Slash. If you have a chance and could go see him, it'd mean the world to him. Like I said, he's not in good shape. Although I guess, knowing Chucky, that shouldn't come as a big surprise. No, I said meaningfully. It sure shouldn't. And then I shook my head sadly. And so did Slash. I still think of Chucky from time to time. I like to hope Chucky's doing better. But knowing Chucky, as I do by pretending to know Chucky, chances aren't good. Oh, and that girl who was quietly sobbing on the elevator? I saw her again, but only once, and it was the damnedest thing. It was months later, and I entered the elevator, and there she was. Except this time she wasn't alone. She was with the gregarious guy, the guy I'd seen console her months earlier. But now he wasn't consoling her. He was yelling at her and telling her she had no business looking through his drawers. Her head was bent down, and she quietly wept.
Years ago, I was friends with Andy Warhol and was present when he uttered his prophetic statement, "In the future, everybody will be famous for 15 minutes." Andy did not live to see his words take shape in our world. I work in the following manner. I listen to my subject, and I absorb all he has to say. When I discover his essence, I become him. My process is the same that Lee Strasberg teaches actors. You could call it method writing, I suppose. I had Mr. McDonald over to my brownstone for an afternoon tea, and he stayed a month. It was the longest month of my life as I listened to what he called his great antidotes. These were either dishwater dull true stories or preposterous lies. He wrote The Jerk for Steve Martin. He was Canada's Minister of Defense. He used to like Brussels sprouts, but not anymore. I'm still afraid to enter my guest room, which is filled knee-high with his SNL jackets, Norm Show t-shirts, and dirty work hats. And, hiding among his laundry, hypodermic needles. Now he phones me and I leave the poor answering machine to listen. But still, I remain confident that I will find the truth of the man, which will then enable me to become him. I am determined to make Mr. McDonald appear interesting, engaging, and most of all, funny. This last bit is the most difficult task, because the man is simply not funny. Fortunately, I have a razor-sharp sense of humor, always have. Here's an example of what I find humorous. A professor of history buys a dog, and a colleague asks, "Have you thought of a name for the beast?" "Why, certainly," says the professor. "I was thinking of naming it the Holy Roman Empire." "But why?" asks his bewildered friend. "Well, it's really quite simple," replies the history professor. "You see, the dog is neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire." I should say I recounted this joke to Mr. McDonald at an early meeting and was answered with the blankest of stares. Pearls before swine. But my opinions are meaningless because in this upside-down world, Mr. McDonald is famous and I am not. In the future, everyone will be anonymous for 15 minutes.
Chapter 16, Winning Big. I've been winning a lot of money very quickly. Gabe and I are sitting in the coffee shop, looking at his iPad, which is displaying properties in Billings. Things are moving beautifully fast. Can it really keep up? My bets are consistent, between 10 and 20,000 per game, usually one game a night, on a rare occasion two. Much to the delight and surprise of Gabe, I have had five straight nights where I have made no bets at all. But Gabe is not the only one noticing. Jimmy, Bill, and Jake, who all work at the Mirage Sportsbook and are fine fellows, have noticed my restraint, and I can tell from their faces that they are not happy. It isn't the money. They've seen me win much more in much less time. I've never made them break sweat. But this time, I haven't been playing like a loser, and the boys at the book don't like this one bit. Where's the old Norm? Sweating, pacing, wincing, losing. Who is this reasonable man making these reasonable bets? Gabe and I agree that tomorrow I will pay off my Mirage marker, take my profit, and move by action over to Caesar's Palace. But I have one last bet to make before we go. An hour later, I'm in line at the sportsbook. I have been up all night studying the lines, and I've discovered a trend that I don't think any of the big boys have seen. This is when you can make serious money. My plan is to bet higher than my regular bet, since Texas looks like a lock. I decide to bet $30,000 on the underdog Rangers, which would net me $75,000 and change. But I never make that bet. I never make that bet because Providence steps in at the last second. $10 million on Fernandez, a man whispers. Certainly, Mr. Gardino, another man whispers. In the line next to mine stands a hulking man, whose expensive suit makes him look no less a brute. He reaches the front just as I do and opens a suitcase filled with chips, which the teller begins to painstakingly count. I look up at the board to see who this mafioso is betting on. Fernandez is a boxer, and he pays 11-1. This guy is betting $10 million on a huge underdog. That's good enough for me. I empty my pockets. $360,000 on Fernandez, I say. Jimmy looks at me suspiciously. I'm going to need authorization for that, he says, and he makes a call to the back office. Moments later, the head of the sports book, Jake, comes out. You sure you want to bet this much, Norm? He knows if I win, it will pay $4 million. He also knows I have been winning consistently for a week. What he does not know is that once I win this bet, I will never make another wager as long as I live. He thinks a good long time before finally rapping the top of the table. Okay, book it. Good luck. The fight isn't on for another 4 hours, so I wander over to the poker room and sweat Gabe for a bit. I decide I'll give him the business. Oh, I bet it all, Gabe. I had a hunch. I wanted to get a rise out of him. Oh, God, this never would have happened if the chips were in the safe where they should be. What's the bet? It's a boxer. His name's Fernandez. A guy from the other side of the table hears me and lets out a big laugh. Fernandez? That bum has a glass jaw. He won't last 30 seconds. Gabe checks his iPhone. He's even money. Yeah, I say. He is now. The line tends to move dramatically when a guy from the mob bets $10 million. You're kidding, says Gabe. You saw this? Yeah. That's why I got my bet in at 11-1 while they were still counting his ton of chips. Gabe smiles. Lucky man. Thanks, Gabe. That evening, I invite everyone I meet in the casino to my room, and we settle around the giant TV screen. We have shrimp cocktail and beef on skewers and bowls of ice cream and tumblers of scotch and cigars and women and just about everything a man could want. In my hand is a ticket that will soon be worth $4 million, much more than my goal. I get my realtor from Billings on the phone, and we talk for a good hour. I explain I'll be needing a bigger ranch, and I explain I will be needing an arsenal of weapons to keep the bad people away from the ranch. After I get off the phone, I conference with Adam Egitt in the corner to explain in detail what his duties will be on the ranch. Before I can finish, the fighters enter the ring. The man announces the challenger Fernandez's name, and my hotel room goes nuts. The ref is giving his instructions to the fighters, and I notice how calm Fernandez is as he stares his opponent down. We all rise to our feet as the bell sounds to begin round one. Fernandez moves in quickly, and the other fellow hits him and knocks him out. The hotel room is silent for a moment. Then I scream as loud as I can. I grab a pillow from the sofa and rip it open, sending feathers flying. I hit the wall as hard as I can, and there's a huge hole where my now broken hand was. I grab the glass table in the center of the room and overturn it, sending shrimp and ice and nachos and drinks spilling onto the carpet. I run over to the counter where the liquor and glasses are, and with a backward swipe of my arm, I clear it, and broken glass flies everywhere. My guests shield their eyes and try to find the door. There's a great deal of noise now as people stampede out of the room. Now it is only me and Adam Egget, who is sitting on the edge of the sofa. "What's the problem, buddy?" he says. I kick him as hard as I can in the shins and race down to the sports book. "What the hell happened?" I shout to no one and everyone. Jimmy smiles his wry smile. "An 11-1 dog lost. It's been known to happen, Norm." "But Jimmy, what about that mob guy? He bet $10 million. Jimmy laughs. "Oh, my God, Norm, why didn't you ask me? That was no mob guy. That was Longshot Louie. He bets anything that's 5-1 or better. He's got so much money, he doesn't care." "Longshot Louie," I said. "Longshot Louie?" "Yeah," says Jimmy, in his calm, seen-it-all voice. "Hey, speaking of long shots, you been watching the ball game? Nobody saw that coming." In a daze, I look up at a TV screen and see that the Texas Rangers are ahead 5-1 in the ninth. I get the boys and we check out to go over to Caesar's, and I'm seething. Gabe keeps saying, "Man on tilt." We finally get there, go through the whole procedure again, and get $300,000 in chips. This time I make 15 bets on baseball games, for $20,000 a game. Hours later, I'm lying on my new bed, hugging my new pillow. Adam Egget sits in a chair beside the bed, sweating hard and staring at me. Gabe enters. "Hey, pal, I heard you've been flipping coins. What's the damage?" "That's what Gabe calls it when you make a bet that is 50-50, except for the juice. He calls it flipping coins against a really lucky guy." Adam Egget jumps to his feet. "Gabe, he lost 15 straight bets. What are the odds of that, right?" I wish he hadn't asked, because I know Gabe will know the answer. "About 1 in 30,000, he says. And this gets Adam Egget excited, and more sweat drips down his big squid-billy head. "Then he's due, right, Gabe? He's due. I mean, what's the chance of him losing another?" "A little more than 50%. "But that makes no sense. He's due." "Don't tell me. Tell the coin." I tell them both to scram, and I lie there, wallowing in my man-made pride and cursing all that is good in the world. I pick up the phone. "You guys got any Wild Turkey 101 down there?" "Yes, sir." "Send up all you got." 5 weeks pass. Chapter 17. First Week at Work. The languorous joy of Mohonk, where we had had breakfast on cedar tables in the mornings and spent our evenings laughing with drink and new friendships in front of a roaring bonfire next to the lake, became, as all things do, a memory. The next week, we were on the 17th floor of Rockefeller Center, a beehive of activity and stinging rejection, where we had to learn, and learn fast. We were all just kids back then. Well, not kids, really, but we were very, very immature. I got to know my fellow freshmen very quickly. Jay Moore, Dave Attell, and Sarah Silverman. One of them I loved, and one of them I hated. I hated Dave Attell, but I only hated him because I loved Sarah Silverman, and she loved Dave Attell. The first year was tough. Sarah, Jay, and I had been hired as featured players. It was a tough position to be in, languishing somewhere just shy of being a full writer and a full performer. We were expected to write sketches for the big dogs, but we were also allowed to write ourselves small parts in the sketches. The problem was, we were stand-up comics, and we were competing with actual sketch writers who knew what they were doing. These writers were very smart and literate, and many of them had attended Ivy League schools. The roster was made up of Ian Maxtone Graham, Lou Morton, Dave Mandel, Steve Corin, Marilyn Suzanne Miller, Steve Luckner, and, the brightest and funniest of them all, Jim Downey. You just didn't get much smarter than these young lions of comedy. That's why I was so flattered when I learned that they had given me the nickname Einstein. Hey, nice sketch this week, Einstein. I bet you have some good ideas for Alec Baldwin, huh, Einstein? Hey, Einstein, we're hungry. Can you get us a bunch of sandwiches, Einstein? That kind of thing. I was honored that these smart, educated folks had given me the moniker, but the truth was, I was nowhere near as smart as Alfred Einstein. Shoot. I wasn't even as smart as that new scientist, the one with the wheelchair and the funny way of talking. But I wasn't going to let the eggheads and blue stockings in the writer's room know that. Despite the high praise of my co-workers, I had trouble getting any of my sketches on the air. But I remembered what Downey had said and stayed close to the Fab Four and their leader, my friend Adam Sandler. Some of the writers would give me bit parts and skits, which allowed me to keep my job. Ian Maxtone Graham, Adam McKay, Steve Higgins, and Tim Herlihy were especially kind, and Sandler was always sure to throw me a bone. One time, I came close to blowing it with Sandler, because I was a rookie and not used to the nuances of acting in sketches. Probably the toughest part of acting, and something you never learn in stand-up, is having the sharp wit to react when someone calls you by a different name. Sandler had written me into a sketch as his co-star. It was a huge opportunity for me, and I was determined not to blow it like I had blown every other opportunity in the joke I called my life. I studied that sketch from front to back, which I had been told by Downey was the correct order in which to study it. It was my big break, and I wasn't about to screw it up. On Saturday night, I was nervous, but ready, like a great athlete. We were trying out the sketch at dress rehearsal. The only way you got the sketch on the real live show at 11:30 p.m. was to destroy at dress at 8 p.m. Sandler hit me with his first line. "Hey, Frank, did you hear about that meteor hurtling toward the Earth?" Now, by this time, I lived in the same apartment building, the Regency House, that Adam lived in, and we shared an office, so I was good friends with him. And he never called me Frank. He always called me Norm. Naturally, when he called me Frank, I didn't respond. And so Adam repeated his line, but I noticed there was an edge in his voice. If I'd been thinking, I'd have realized at this point that I was Frank, because Adam and I were the only two people in the sketch. But I wasn't thinking. I was looking at things around the set, one table in particular. It was made of brown wood and reminded me of a table I'd once seen in a table store. So the two of us didn't say anything at all. About 20 minutes passed, and finally the show ended. Boy, Adam was really steamed at me about that one. And Lauren was, too. Every Wednesday, we would submit our sketches. And this is where the most curious thing would happen. From the beginning, I had submitted my answering machine sketch, which I knew would be a blockbuster, and in which I had a starring role. The sketch was based on the first joke I ever told on stage and was the funniest thing ever. Seriously. I wrote the sketch and brought it to the table every single week. Some weeks, it would get no laughs at all. Others, it would get two or three or four. That's the way comedy works. They either hate you or they don't completely hate you. You can never tell which it will be beforehand. Every time I submitted the answering machine sketch, I would be sure to write Sarah Silverman in, as she was struggling, like me, and any airtime was valuable to her. Also, using Sarah gave me a dynamite end to the sketch. Sarah would say, "Boy, mister, these answering machines are really annoying." And I would say, "Frankly, lady, I don't give a damn." And then give Sarah a big smooch. This gave the sketch a big laugh at the end by spoofing a well-known motion picture, and it also allowed me to give a big smooch to Sarah, whom I was falling deeply in love with. At the time, Sarah and Dave Attell ruled the New York stand-up scene. Sarah, with her sly subversive satire masked by the sweetest of deliveries. And Attell, a joke machine to rival Dangerfield himself. She was elegant and unafraid. He was rumpled, unshaven, and a chain smoker. They were the Bogey and Bacall of the New York comedy circle. What chance did I have? What woman was going to choose Alfred Einstein over Humphrey Bogart? Still, I vowed I would win Sarah's love. No one at SNL knew more about matters of the heart than David Spade, so I asked his advice. "Just ask her out, buddy," Spade told me. Just ask her out. So simple and yet so incredibly complex. No wonder David Spade was so good with the ladies. I was pulling an all-nighter in the writer's room, trying to finish the answering machine sketch for Wednesday's read-through, when I spotted Sarah in the hallway. I decided to make my intentions known. "You're dreadful pretty, Sarah," I said, "and I'd be honored if you would lay down with me. And not in the restroom, either. I will take you out to a restaurant, and you can order beefsteak that I will pay for. We will coo and whisper and smile meaningful smiles, and we will reduce the whole world and its people to our small table and the two of us. And then, afterward, I will take you to my bed, and we will be like swine." She ran away, and I realized that I'd made a big mistake. You see, Sarah was a liberated woman, and she didn't need any man to buy her a beefsteak. She made exactly the same salary as I did, minus the 30% that they automatically took off on account of she was a woman. And what a woman. In a way, Sarah's lucky she never met the payroll clerk at SNL, or they might have taken off 60%. The day after my clumsy pass, I was served a restraining order that said I was not allowed to be within 100 yards of my loved one. This made the cameramen on the show furious, because when Sarah and I were in the same sketch, they had to resort to ridiculously wide shots. I fell into a deep depression, heartbroken. About a week later, I walked into the Comedy Cellar to do a set. I had some new material and wanted to try it out. They had recently come out with a new telephone that had its own built-in answering machine. The first thing I saw was the two of them, Dave and Sarah, canoodling at a corner table. They may as well have been up in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. Well, I saw red, and I went over to Colin Quinn. Colin was, and is, the smartest comedian alive, and a great guy to boot. This was long before he joined the cast of SNL and destroyed my life. "Colin," I said, "you're from New York. Where does a guy go to hire a hitman?" Colin laughed. "What do you want with a hitman?" "Can you keep a secret, Colin? I plan to have Dave Attell murdered, and then, once he's out of the way, convince Sarah to lay down with me. I should have paused to give Colin a chance to answer my question regarding his ability to keep a secret before I spilled my whole plan. As it turned out, Colin Quinn was a huge blabbermouth who wound up prating like a magpie about the entire murder plot as soon as he got the chance. But I didn't know that then. "Don't worry," I said. "There's between $50 and $75 in it for you." "Are you completely serious about this, Norm? I mean, there's plenty of fish in the sea." I knew right away he wasn't talking about fish. Colin was the king of metaphors. He meant there were plenty of ladies in the sea. "No offense, Colin, but the longer it takes for me to listen to your yapping, the longer it will take to have Dave Attell murdered and that very night lay down with Sarah." Colin looked very nervous, but finally said, "All right, I know a guy." Colin called me the next day and said it was all set up. I was to meet the hitman at the corner booth of the Stage Deli the next day at noon. I asked Colin if he could change it to the Carnegie Deli, because it is a far superior deli. He said it was too late, so I thanked him, but he had to have heard the bitter disappointment in my voice. I mean, if you're going to meet a hitman at a Midtown deli, why the Stage Deli? Why not the Carnegie Deli? The next day, I sat in the Stage Deli and waited for the hitman to arrive. He was late, so I spent my time thinking about the delicious pastrami on rye they had at the Carnegie Deli, and how I would not be eating one today. I saw a police officer enter the joint, and I got nervous. When he slipped into the booth across from me, I got really nervous. "You, Norm?" he asked. "I'm not talking to any coppers," I said. "Who's a copper?" the cop asked. "You are." "I'm no copper. Where'd you get a ridiculous idea like that?" "Well, you're wearing a police uniform." I was very good at spotting cops. He looked down at himself and saw that I was right and began sweating profusely and stuttering and hitting his forehead twice with the palm of his hand and saying, "Stupid, stupid!" It took him a few minutes to compose himself, but finally he said, "Oh, this. You see, I've been walking the beat the last 10 years, and I just got promoted to undercover cop, but you know what they say, old habits die hard." He seemed relaxed again. "So you're an undercover cop," I said. "Why should I talk to you?" Well, he started the whole sweating and stuttering and hitting his forehead routine all over again. I just got up to leave when he blurted out, "I'm a bad cop, a dirty cop." "You are?" "Yeah, of course I am. That's what makes me such a good hitman. I have my own gun, and nobody ever suspects a cop." The waitress came up and addressed the hitman with the police costume on. "Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to keep your voice down. You're frightening many of the customers." The hitman had been speaking very loudly, in a sort of panic. I would find out later that he wasn't a bad cop at all. I mean, he was a bad cop in the sense that he was no good at being a cop, but he was not a corrupt cop. He pulled out a large tape recorder and hit the play button and the record button simultaneously, and we began hammering out a deal. He would murder Dave Attell, and in return I would give him $355. We haggled for well over an hour before finally settling on the $355 figure, which made me very angry after he arrested me and I realized he could have just accepted my first offer and saved us both a lot of time. When I got to the precinct, they told me I was allowed one phone call. "Hello, Colin? It's Norm. You're from New York. Where does a guy go to hire an attorney?" Chapter 18, The Trial. Only a month earlier, I had been on national television, appearing in bit parts in Ellen Cleghorn sketches. And now here I stood before a judge, wearing some sort of ridiculous orange jumpsuit, found guilty by a jury of my peers, about to be sentenced, and trying to figure how it had come to this. And maybe I was guilty, but of what, really? attempting to hire a hitman to kill a close friend of mine? Well, if they convicted everybody who was guilty of that, they'd have to build a lot more prisons in this country, brother. And what had I done anyway? I had never actually met a hitman. By the prosecution's own admission, the police officer I met with at the Stage Deli had never killed a single man in exchange for cash. All I'd really done was eat a Reuben with a policeman. I had a very good lawyer, and he tried to get the charge reduced to eating a Reuben with a policeman. But the judge did not go for it. I thought we had a pretty good defense. We made the point that people die every day. It's not such a big deal. We showed the jury a picture of Sarah Silverman, and they all agreed she was a knockout, and one man even made a loud wolf whistle. We tried to get the jury to believe that I had an evil twin brother, and it was he who was guilty, and not me. And we even told them not to feel bad charging me with the crime because we understood that it was a natural mistake. But that fell apart when it turned out my evil twin brother had an ironclad alibi. He had been down south on a multi-state killing spree at the time. Even though I was found guilty, I never blamed my lawyer. I mean, he was no Ben Matlock, but he was good. The problem was, I was just too guilty. But I was a man, I'd made a mistake, and I was willing to face the consequences of my actions. I started to think how maybe I should have taken that plea bargain, though. My lawyer was very good friends with the DA. He had come to me one day, giddy, and told me of the deal he had struck. If I pleaded guilty and apologized to Mr. Attell in court, I would receive a sentence of one mid-afternoon in prison. "No way," I said. "I want my name cleared, and I will never apologize to Dave Attell. He was the guy I was trying to have murdered, and you want me to apologize to him?" Well, now, as I stood to hear the judge's decision, that plea bargain was starting to look pretty good, and that sentence of one mid-afternoon was starting to seem pretty short. "Mr. McDonald, you are found guilty and sentenced to serve 40 years in a maximum security prison. Is there anything you would like to say to this court?" Oh, I had plenty to say to this court, all right. "Your Honor, you have sentenced me to prison. But let me say this. The real prisons in this country are the classrooms and the cubicles. The real prisons are the mausoleums we call houses. And the life sentence we are given is a job where we have to wear a tie that slowly strangles us, and a woman who finds us full and leaves us empty. I will go to your prison, it is true, but there is something honest and true and noble about prison. You give up your freedom, yes, but in exchange you are given a roof over your head, 3 squares a day, and all the morphine you want. And I guess that's good enough for the likes of me." "There's no morphine in prison, son," the judge sighed. "What?" I had clearly been misinformed. Chapter 19. Doing Time. Prison was a scary place, and the first day was worst of all. The first thing that happened was the guards took away all of the stuff I'd brought from home. They took away my wallet and my keys and my 40 pounds of Omaha steaks and my cake with the file inside. They took away my dirty work hat and my Norm Show t-shirt and my SNL jacket and all the rest of my free world clothes, and they made me wear their striped pajamas. They even took away my name. But that part was actually pretty cool, because they gave me a number instead, like I was a robot from outer space. Mine was 602-3102. Then they walked me to my cell, past dangerous-looking convicts, who chanted, "Fresh meat! Fresh meat! Fresh meat!" "You may as well stop with your chanting, boys," I answered. "I don't have a single Omaha steak on me. They all got took." The convicts continued their chant, but there was a puzzled tone to it. The guards threw me in a cell, where a big, sullen man was sitting on the lower of two steel bunks. He looked to be